You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 2013 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the third class in a series given by Brother Dyron Hamlin on the subject, The Big Picture, Faith-Boosting Evidence for the Why of All Things. This class is titled, Historical.
Good morning, everybody. So let's. I want to follow up on three things from yesterday before we get started. So number one, I had a lot of questions about TED Talks, and I wanted to really clarify that the concept of TED, it's not a guy named TED, it's technology, entertainment, and design. And the reason I went to the TED Talks to look at that was, again, thinking through the lens of objective evidence that demonstrates that God's way is the best way. So technology, entertainment, design is just a collective group of secular scientists. And believe me, if you watch many of their talks, you see a lot of very secular, humanistic themes coming out. So I wanted to make sure that you guys knew what you were getting into if you were going to go watch some TED Talks. That having been said, they're very fascinating. And it doesn't hamper my belief that all things do converge to the truth. And you know, in support, to me, it's interesting to see that in support of what we read yesterday, that we can do nothing against the truth but for it. And to me, a lot of those folks are explicitly and specifically trying to do things against the truth that we, as we know it, and in reality, all they're doing is supporting what we already know to be true. So to me, that's what TED is all about. I wanted to follow up too. I had one or two questions. Asher did play baseball with his cast on, and he did get a base hit. And so I think he was kind of the envy of all his teammates. The last thing I wanted to clarify, we talked a lot yesterday about happiness and the pursuit of happiness, and we ended off considering this fact that God has created us with eternity in our hearts that people try to fill with all sorts of things in vain. And let's look over at, let's start reading here in Philippians chapter 4. Philippians 4, verses 8 through 13. In conclusion, my brothers, fill your minds with those things that are good and that deserve praise, things that are true, noble, right, pure, lovely, and honorable. Put into practice what you learned and received from me, both from my words and from my actions, and the God who gives us peace will be with you. In my life, in union with the Lord, it is a great joy to me that after so long a time, you once more had the chance of showing that you care for me. I don't mean that you had stopped caring for me. You just had no chance to show it. And I'm not saying this because I feel neglected, for I have learned to be satisfied with what I have. I know what it is to be in need and what it is to have more than enough. I have learned this secret so that anywhere, at any time, I am content. Whether I am full or hungry, whether I have too much or too little, I have the strength to face all conditions by the power that Christ gives me. You know, I hear a verse often quoted that says, "In this world you will have trouble." I think that's Solomon's point that we really discussed yesterday. And I hear people cut that verse off at that point. They say, in this world you will have trouble. And that's a true statement. But what's Jesus follow that up with? Be of good cheer. I have overcome the world. Be of good cheer, for I have overcome the world. In this world you will have trouble. But be of good cheer. Be content. Have that feeling of peace that we can overcome through him and through the power that we have through him. You know, again, as I mentioned on the first day, and when we think about the structure of the classes this week, I'll be honest, I struggled a little bit to understand sort of where Solomon goes from this vast and powerful conclusion about how we ought to live our lives. You know, the first day we looked in the natural at some faith-boosting ideas that really demonstrate the truth as we understand it. We looked at creation and we looked at our physical bodies, and it's a logical transition to me that Solomon then would begin to look at you know, his own, not just physical body, but his emotional needs and his spiritual needs. And, you know, we went through yesterday, I think, a pretty good lesson to show what it is that will bring us that true sense of satisfaction. So where does Solomon go from here? Let's start off actually in Isaiah chapter 43, verses 8 and 9. I think of these as kind of the theme verses for today. Isaiah 43, verses 8 and 9. God says, "Summon my people to court. They have eyes, but they are blind. They have ears, but they are deaf. Summon the nations to come to the trial. Which of their gods can predict the future? Which of them foretold what is happening now? Let these gods bring in their witnesses to prove that they are right, to testify to the truth of their words." Historically, as this passage goes on to tell us, Israel has been one of God's greatest witnesses. Solomon, at this point in his sort of exploration of the why of all things, and I gotta, since I'm talking sort of on the heels of John's class, I would love to think of this book as being written by a grandfatherly Solomon that sits around with all of his grandchildren and great-grandchildren and says, "Boys and girls, let me tell you what I have discovered." And this is what it is. So having led us through his own personal development of understanding what motivates him and how he can achieve personal satisfaction, I think it's only right that he turns his view outwards and he thinks about the world around him. And he sees what? Let's look over at Ecclesiastes chapter 3. And to be honest again with you, a historical view of the big picture is not as uplifting as maybe even we came to see yesterday. A historical view of this world is not a pretty one. The history of this world from the beginning, from the time that man began to seek out many inventions, as we'll read in Ecclesiastes 7, has not been a pretty one. Nor does it continue to be one. You know, we talked yesterday, we are having a wonderful week. We enjoy tremendous blessings, and yet we can think, because of the information that's so easily accessible to us these days, about all kinds of suffering that's going on all over the world. We can think about some suffering that's happening in this room, in our own lives, with health, with loved ones that are dealing with difficulties. The history of the world is a tragedy. It really is, up until a certain point. And that's what we want to get to today. In Ecclesiastes chapter 3, we left off after verse 14, so let's start reading again at verse 15. "Whatever happens or can happen has already happened before. God makes the same thing happen again and again." And if you've ever used the words, "history repeats itself," again, those are not original words either. "In addition, I have also noticed that in this world, you will find wickedness where justice and right ought to be. I told myself, God is going to judge the righteous and the evil alike, because everything, every action will happen at its own set time. I decided that God is testing us to show us that we are no better than animals. After all, the same fate awaits man and animal alike. One dies just like the other. They are the same kind of creature. A human being is no better off than an animal, because life has no meaning for either. They are both going to the same place, the dust. They both came from it. They will both go back to it. How can anyone be sure that a man's spirit goes upward while an animal's spirit goes down into the ground? So I realized then that the best thing we can do is enjoy what we have worked for. There is nothing else we can do. There is no way for us to know what will happen after we die. Then I looked again at all the injustice that goes on in this world, The oppressed were crying, and no one would help them. No one would help them because the oppressors had power on their side. I envy those who are dead and gone. They are better off than those who are still alive. But better off than either are those who have never been born, who have never seen the injustice that goes on in this world. We do well to consider the injustice that goes on in the world. You do well to consider the injustice that may have gone on in your neighbor's life that happens to be doing a thing that you don't like and that you find this person greatly offensive. Maybe that person has suffered at the hands of injustice. That is the history of the world in a nutshell. I want to talk real quick about the history of the world in a nutshell. And I really wish that this whiteboard was landscape and not portrait, but it's portrait. Because this is an exercise I think that is worthwhile. I love Google Earth. Anybody use that application, Google Earth? And you can spin the world around and you can look at it. And you can picture continents and places and people and things going on at all points in time. I want to break down the history of the world in a nutshell for you real quick, okay? And I'll do this starting with a little geography lesson. All right, so I'm pretty good at drawing the United States, so here it is. Here it is. There's Florida, there's Texas, and then Mexico's down here. There's a peninsula there, and it goes down. And here's South America down here, which is a big blob. And then there's, where'd Florida go? Okay, I should have brought this up a little higher. Okay. We come around here, go to Baja, boom, and then Alaska's out there. I'm sorry, I ran out of room for Alaska. Okay, and then we have Canada and a bunch of other stuff up there. All right, here's Greenland. Here's Iceland. Wow, I'm not going to have nearly enough space for Asia, but you kind of get the picture. England, I'll give you guys a special treatment there since you're here. Got you. That's about right latitude-wise. And here's some Nordic countries and other things in France and a Mediterranean Sea. Now, I don't want to blow by this because this is a land that God cares for, right? And this is the apple of his eye. And we get wrapped up sometimes in our historical view or sometimes even our current events view and we think, you know, what does this have to do with, you know, prophecy and fulfilled events and we ought to keep our eyes very focused on this region of the world. And so I'll draw it carefully. There's the Red Sea, and here's Africa down here, which kind of comes out. And I'm sorry, Rick and Sonia, for that. Wow, now it's really tall because that's the Mediterranean. So we're going to just bring it here, around there, like that. That's all gone. All right, now let's put some time to this. And we didn't forget Asia. This, and here's Saudi Arabia, and then Asia is that way. Okay, that's the world. This is why I love Google Earth, because they draw it a lot better than I do, and you can zoom in and look at all sorts of interesting little individual places. Okay, so what happened? What happened in, according to Archbishop Usher, the year 4004 BC, things were set in motion. Things were set in motion that affected our entire planet. And I tend towards a young Earth philosophy, but I'm okay with old Earth philosophy. You've heard sort of my take on either. But let's pick it up where history began, because that's what we're talking about today is history. Okay, so let's pick it up at 4,000 years before Christ, right? And it's interesting to me, too. And there's a movement to call this BCE. You hear this, right? It's been a pretty effective movement. We don't call it before Christ anymore. That would be too Christian. It puts too much credence in a random, meaningless event that happened supposedly 2,000 years ago, according to our secular historians. But leaving that thought with you, 4,000 BC, you have Adam and Eve living in the Garden of Eden. Brother Wilfred Elaine tended to think, and I'm going to go ahead and draw the Sea of Galilee, the Jordan, and the Dead Sea right there. Brother Wilfred Elaine makes a great case for the Garden of Eden actually being in Israel, which I think is an interesting thought. So let's just assume that they're there. Now, time passes on. The earth becomes populated. There's about, what do we figure, about a billion people about the time that the flood happens. The flood happens about 1,500 years after creation, or after the historical record begins, right? So now we're at 2,500 B.C. and the flood. This is a monumental event. And regardless of whether you think it was a localized or a worldwide flood, every culture of today has a big flood story. You can go to Iceland and they talk about the flood, and it's so fascinating if you ever have the time to go look at the flood accounts of some of these remote cultures. They're fascinating. Just some really fascinating mythology that comes into play. But suffice it to say, everybody's got a flood account. So after this point, we have Noah and his three sons and their three wives and Noah's wife repopulating the earth, right? We have eight people. We're reset the population of the earth down to eight. There's probably been some rearrangement in the way I see things of the continents, and thankfully they turned out better than what I've drawn up here. I can do better with landscape. So we go Noah, Shem, Ham, Japheth, and they begin to populate the known globe. We have Japheth settling up here, become the Europeans. We have the Semites settling here, and we have the children of Ham settling down here. I do think it's interesting that in the land of Canaan, who was one of the children of Ham, the fourth of the sons of Ham, is where God tells Abraham to go. Abraham, I want you to sort of horn in on Canaan's land. And it's interesting to me the potential, the conflict that obviously created, and the conflict that we still find today. And one of the things I love about a historical view like this is you begin to realize how relevant and how recent all of this is. It's still so relevant today. And it's written in the pages for us to appreciate that God cares very deeply about this planet. I was talking to the teens this morning about a quote from Carl Sagan, who described our planet. I alluded to that video, Privileged Planet. They quote Carl Sagan to open that video, and he says that we are an insignificant pale blue dot in a vast universe. And, of course, then they go on to make their case that we're not so insignificant and that we do have purpose and that God does care for us. So God has his hand in every point in history, and you have to wonder when God says, get up from your land and from your family and leave your family and go to the land of Canaan. You know, if just that small command, just that small point in time where Abraham migrates into the land of Canaan has turned world events completely. Turned world events, and we witness it today. And I think sometimes we don't appreciate the development of history in our current lives. We don't see sometimes and appreciate the effects that these ripple effects that these events had. Okay, so we have Abraham moving in. We have, according to what we're then told from this time on, we have Isaac, we have Jacob, we have the children of Israel moving down to Egypt to escape famine, right? So they're down here. And everyone always wonders about the Asian continent and how the Asian continent became populated. Did you know that the Brahmin class of priests in India, Brahmin, does that look familiar to you? They're direct descendants of Abraham. And you see some of the wisdom and philosophy that comes out of some of that religion, and you can hear echoes of the truth. You hear echoes. It's not unusual that we see other religions and other thought patterns and things. Again, we have this concept of convergence, is that these things all originated from eight people post-flood. These ideas are not new. These ideas were established from the very beginning, and they expanded to the earth from there. One of the things I love to think in terms of space, too. So we're thinking in terms of time and space here. Think in terms of space. How long would it take you to sail a boat from Africa to South America? It's been done. People do it, right? And we think in terms of planes and how hard it must be and all of this. Hey, if I was an adventurous 15-year-old back in that time, I told Mario this. I'm realizing this more as time goes on. I think I would have been a sailor. And I might not have lived through the journey, but I have this thirst for exploration. I love to go find things. And is it that unusual that you would have the descendants of Ham migrating towards the coast and spreading out and trying to find their lives? And you see how quickly this develops. This journey can be done in a month across the vast Atlantic Ocean. Same thing on the other, in the other direction. You hear about the people coming across the land bridge. You have people spreading east and west. You have the children of Israel, which we follow closely, leaving the land of Egypt and settling back in their own land after wandering around in the wilderness. And they established the kingdom of Israel, which is a clearly historically documented set of events. So after they settled in the land of Israel, this is what now, about 1500 B.C., we have the nation of Israel, right? Monumental events that sort of keep us on track through time. And 1,000 years, of course, the older you get, the less time 1,000 years seems like. That's not a long time. Think about what's happened in our last 100 years as a planet. Think about all the crazy advancements that we've had over the last 100 years. And the world was pretty much kind of the same until the last 100 and 150 years. There was some advancement. There was some ups and some downs. So 1500 B.C. to about 600 B.C., and now we have who coming into town? We have, well, a little before that, we have Assyria, right? And then we have Babylon. And now we get into Nebuchadnezzar's image, right? Nebuchadnezzar's image would tell us that there are basically four main world powers: Assyria, Babylon, the Medes and the Persians, Greece, and Rome. And don't let it be lost on you that long before Rome ever came onto the scene, a guy named Nebuchadnezzar had a dream. A guy named Nebuchadnezzar had a dream that there would be four main empires, and that the last one would be as strong as iron and would have two parts. And there's not a historian in the world that would argue with that. And that happened long before he saw that vision long before that ever came to pass. So the Babylonians bring us up into about 200 BC. We have Greece. This is 200. And then we have Rome coming in, 43 B.C., something like that. And then we come to year zero. Now, I just want to pick up in Rome. I want to show you something that I find interesting, too, just to show you there's a little bit of precedent for this exercise, the history of the world in a nutshell. You thought the title of my classes was ambitious. This is a video of how the world's population has changed since 1 AD, the time of the Roman Empire. So each dot on this little map represents about 1 million people. Okay, so watch how this changes over time, and you can just kind of watch in the background as this goes. Over the last 2,000 years, we've basically witnessed the Roman Empire and its offshoots, right? This was predicted long before it came to pass. And you'll see the growth is primarily in Asia and India. Lots of population change there. As time goes on, you see the effects of famines. You see the effects of wars. You see dots come in and out. So if you look down here, this is the Mayan Empire begins to be established as some folks are making it from the western coast of Africa over to South America. Again, that distance doesn't look so far when you look at it like that. The rise of Islam gives us some population along the southern coast of the Mediterranean Sea right here. So now we're up to about 750 AD. 850. Now we have the Viking conquest. So the first sort of explorations, at least from the Western European nations over to the Americas. Still, you know, it's interesting and it's humbling in a sense to look at the United States and see there's just not a lot going on there. And look how long into this history of the world we are. We're at 1100 AD. We're over 5,000 years in. And still nothing going on in America. This is 1200 AD now. You see quite a population growth. There's the Mongols in China, and you can see this big hole develop in China. Right up in here. A big hole from the violence that went on then. There's the Black Plague in Europe. You can watch some of the dots disappear. Look at the holes begin to develop over there. Population up, population down. You know, we'll talk about this more tomorrow when we talk about culture, because Solomon really addresses this subject of humanity very briefly, this subject of history and what he's seen take place, because it's not a pleasant subject. We're at 1600, still pretty much nothing in the U.S. You're getting some population there on the western coast of Mexico. 1680, 1690, 1700, we're getting significant population. Now we should begin to see the United States populate a bit. Western Europe's getting crowded. This is not an overpopulation speech. 1830, 1840, still we see a little bit of stuff popping up there in the U.S. Bam, 1880, 90, 1900, 1910, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, 2000, 2010, etc. And the rest is conjecture. So pay no more attention to the video. So, interesting. Interesting to think about. What is the point? What is the point of this? Like I said, I think Solomon spends a very brief time on history, and I think it's for a reason. Human history has been rife with tyranny. And when he talks about this oppression, he looks around, he sees the misery of the world. He sees death and dying and plagues and things like this. He can't help but despair. And when he says in chapter 4 that he envies those who are dead and gone, they are better off than those who are alive. I always have to step back and think, what is he talking about? Because certainly if we look over at Ecclesiastes chapter 9, he has a vastly different conclusion over there. In Ecclesiastes 9 verses 3 through 10, he says, one fate comes to all alike, and this is as wrong as anything that happens in this world. As long as people live, their minds are full of evil and madness, and suddenly they die. But anyone who is alive in the world of the living has some hope. A live dog is better than a dead lion. Yes, the living know they are going to die, but the dead know nothing. They have no further reward. They are completely forgotten. Their loves, their hates, their passions all died with them. They will never again take part in anything that happens in this world. Go ahead, eat your food and be happy. Drink your wine and be cheerful. It's all right with God. Always look happy and cheerful. Enjoy life with the woman you love as long as you live the useless life that God has given you in this world. That is my favorite verse to quote Mario. I say, I'm enjoying my meaningless life with you all the days of my life, just like God told me to. Because that is all you will get for all your trouble. Work hard at whatever you do, because there will be no action, no thought, no knowledge, no wisdom in the world of the dead, and that is where you are going. The world is a place of tyranny. It is a place of death. The history of the world is not pretty. The history of the world is rife with tyranny and death. And the question that arises in Solomon's mind is a logical one. Are we animals or are we man? And there is a vast difference between the two. And it should offend you. It should offend you when people talk about us as if we are the most intelligent of the animals. We are vastly different from animals. And when Solomon looks at the world, he looks at the tyranny, he looks at the oppression. If you're living in a world of man acting like animals, It is better that you had never been born, because what an awful, awful place to be. What a horrible place to be. Let's read Daniel chapter 4. If you recognize this picture here, this is a picture of a man who acted an awfully lot like an animal. And basically, God said, you want to act like an animal? We'll make you look like an animal, right? Daniel chapter 4, King Nebuchadnezzar sent the following message to the people of all nations, races, and languages in the world. Greetings, listen to my account of the wonders and miracles which the Supreme God has shown me. How great are the wonders God shows us. How powerful are the miracles he performs. God is king forever. He will rule for all time. What? This coming from a man who has raped and pillaged and tortured all of humanity, the ultimate tyrant, made Hitler look like a saint, this man. Nebuchadnezzar, if you read about the atrocities that he committed in the world, it is unbelievable. I was living comfortably in my palace, enjoying great prosperity, but I had a frightening dream and saw terrifying visions while I was asleep. I ordered all the royal advisors in Babylon to be brought to me so that they could tell me what the dream meant. Then all the fortune tellers, magicians, wizards, and astrologers were brought in, and I told them my dream, but they could not explain it to me. Then Daniel came in. He is also called Belteshazzar after the name of my God. The spirit of the holy gods is in him. So I told him what I had dreamed. I said to him, Belteshazzar, chief of the fortune tellers, I know that the spirit of the holy gods is in you and that you understand all mysteries. This is my dream. Tell me what it means. While I was asleep, I had a vision of a huge tree in the middle of the earth. It grew bigger and bigger until it reached the sky and could be seen by everyone in the world. Its leaves were beautiful and it was loaded down with fruit, enough for the whole world to eat. Wild animals rested in its shade, birds built nests in its branches, and every kind of living being ate its fruit. While I was thinking about the vision, I saw coming down from heaven an angel, alert and watchful. He proclaimed in a loud voice, "Cut the tree down and chop off its branches, strip off its leaves and scatter its fruit. Drive the animals from under it and the birds out of its branches, but leave the stump in the ground with a band of iron and bronze around it. Leave it there in the field with the grass. And now let the dew fall on this man and let him live with the animals and the plants. For 7 years he will not have a human mind, but the mind of an animal. This is the decision of the alert and watchful angels. So then let all people everywhere know that the Supreme God has power over human kingdoms, and that he can give them to anyone he chooses, even to the least important of men. This is the dream I had," said King Nebuchadnezzar. "Now, Belteshazzar, tell me what it means. None of my royal advisors could tell me, but you can, because the spirit of the holy gods is in you." At this, Daniel, who is also called Belteshazzar, was so alarmed that he could not say anything. The king said to him, "Belteshazzar, don't let the dream and its message alarm you." Belteshazzar replied, "Your majesty, I wish that the dream and its explanation applied to your enemies and not to you. The tree, so tall that it reached the sky, could be seen by everyone in the world. Its leaves were beautiful, and it had enough fruit on it to feed the whole world. Wild animals rested under it, and birds made their nests in its branches. Your majesty, you are the tree, tall and strong. You have grown so great that you reach the sky, and your power extends over the whole world. While your majesty was watching, an angel came down from heaven and said, 'Cut the tree down and destroy it, but leave the stump in the ground. Wrap a band of iron and bronze around it and leave it there in the field with the grass. Let the dew fall on this man and let him live there with the animals for 7 years.' This then is what it means, your majesty, and this is what the Supreme God has declared will happen to you. You will be driven away from human society and will live with wild animals. For 7 years you will eat grass like an ox and sleep in the open air where the dew will fall on you. Then you will admit that the Supreme God controls all human kingdoms and that he can give them to anyone he chooses. The angel ordered the stump to be left in the ground. This means that you will become king again when you acknowledge that God rules all the world. So then, your majesty, follow my advice. Stop sinning, do what is right, and be merciful to the poor. Then you will continue to be prosperous." All this did happen to King Nebuchadnezzar. Only 12 months later, while he was walking around on his roof, on the roof of his royal palace in Babylon, he said, "Look how great Babylon is. I built it as my capital city to display my power and might, my glory and majesty. Before the words were out of his mouth, a voice spoke from heaven, King Nebuchadnezzar, listen to what I say. Your royal power is now taken away from you. You will be driven away from human society, live with wild animals, and eat grass like an ox for 7 years. Then you will acknowledge that the supreme God has power over human kingdoms, and that he can give them to anyone he chooses. The words came true immediately. Nebuchadnezzar was driven out of human society and ate grass like an ox. The dew fell on his body, and his hair grew as long as eagle feathers, and his nails as long as bird claws. When the 7 years had ended, said the king, I looked up at the sky, and my sanity returned. I praised the supreme God and gave honor and glory to the one who lives forever. He will rule forever, and his kingdom will last for all time. He looks on the people of the earth as nothing. Angels in heaven and people on earth are under his control. No one can oppose his will or question what he does. When my sanity returned, my honor, my majesty, and the glory of my kingdom were given back to me. My officials and my noblemen welcomed me, and I was given back my royal power with even greater honor than before. And now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise, honor, and glorify the King of Heaven. Everything he does is right and just, and he can humble anyone who acts proudly. Do you know the story of Bucephalus? Moving along from Babylon, we had the Medes and the Persians, actually had a period of a pretty favorable time for the children of Israel, so to speak. Had a couple of kings that were very well spoken of in the scripture, Cyrus, Darius, allowed them to go back, allowed them to rebuild the temple. These things went on, and along comes Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great rode a horse named Bucephalus. If you look up Bucephalus on the internet and you want to do a little research on Bucephalus, it's the most famous horse in the world. The most famous horse in the world. Why was it famous? Alexander the Great was famous for riding this horse into battle, for the first one in, and he never got off his horse. He refused. He would never stoop so low as to get off his horse to bow to the people in the lands that he was coming in to conquer. He too was a ruthless tyrant. A ruthless tyrant. Interesting story about Bucephalus. Let's flip over to Zechariah chapter 9. This is not original material. When we went to Shippensburg in the year 2000, we heard a fantastic talk about this, and I probably will not be able to do it justice to the extent that the brother that presented it there did, but I just want to say that it has been it's a fascinating story, and it's been one that has given me a boost of faith, and so that's why I want to just allude to it today. When we look at the kingdoms of the earth as a whole, this is a significant event in history. Zechariah chapter 9, this is the Lord's message. He has decreed punishment for the land of Hadrach and for the city of Damascus. Not only the tribes of Israel, but also the capital of Syria belong to the Lord. Hamath, which borders on Hadrach, also belongs to him, and so do the cities of Tyre and Sidon with all their skill. This is the punishment for these cities and nations that he's describing. Tyre has built fortifications for herself and has piled up so much silver and gold that it is as common as dirt. But the Lord will take away everything she has. He will throw her wealth into the sea, and the city will be burned to the ground. This happened. This is one of those, one of our best friends is Brother Will Jackson from the Leander meeting down in Texas, outside of Austin. And he'll tell you, he was not raised a believer in any way. And when he heard the story of Tyre being thrown out into the sea, if you don't know that story, the city was built on land. They saw Alexander the Great coming. They were terrified. They ran off to this island just off the coast. Alexander the Great came in, tore the city on land down, used the rubble to build a bridge out to the island, and sieged the island city of Tyre and decimated it. And you can actually still see the ruins there today. So Brother Will tell you that that is one of his main points of faith, is to see that that prophecy that happened before this event came explicitly and specifically true. There's any number of evidences historically that we can look at in the same way. But let's focus back on Alexander the Great. He moves on from Tyre. He does this whole siege. It takes a few years, and on he goes down the coast, bypasses Israel, interestingly enough, sort of leaves him be. And he comes to the city of Ashkelon. Now, in my crude drawing here, Tyre is up here on the northern end of Israel, and Ashkelon is here on the southern coast, basically where the Gaza Strip is today. What does he do? The city of Gaza will see it and suffer great pain. So will Ekron, another Philistine city, and her hopes will be shattered. Gaza will lose her king, and Ashkelon will be left deserted. People of mixed race will live in Ashdod. The Lord says, I will humble all these proud Philistines. They will no longer eat meat with blood in it or other forbidden food. All the survivors will become part of my people and be like a clan in the tribe of Judah. Ekron will become part of my people as the Jebusites did. I will guard my land and keep armies from passing through it. This is what God said. And lo and behold, Alexander comes by and just passes right by Israel. Well, why not? Why not conquer? Why not go into Jerusalem and take over that city? He bypassed it. God said he would. And the story gets interesting. I want to mention one thing that again gives credence to this passage in particular. It mentions the king of Gaza. There's a historical account that Alexander the Great and all of his tyranny dragged the king of Gaza through the streets of the city behind his famous horse, Bucephalus. So we see this Bucephalus sort of at the center of each of Alexander's conquests. He says, I will not allow tyrants to oppress my people anymore. I have seen how my people have suffered. So Zechariah writes that God is not going to allow tyrants to oppress his people. And so the story goes that Alexander went on down to Egypt. Alexander had a number of goals. He wanted to be called the Son of God. He wanted to be known as the ruler of the world. And he achieved, from man's perspective, all these goals. Well, he comes into Jerusalem, the story goes, and he gets off of his horse, Bucephalus, as the priest, the high priest of Jerusalem, walks out to meet him. And he spares the city. And this is a historical account. This is something that you can go research on your own. The man that never dismounted this famous horse, Bucephalus, does so in deference to the people of Jerusalem. And it's because God had protected them. Now, the most fascinating thing to me about this particular passage is, what story comes next? Rejoice. Rejoice, people of Zion. Shout for joy, you people of Jerusalem. Look, your king is coming to you. He comes triumphant and victorious. Does he come on a powerful horse? No. He says he comes triumphant and victorious, but humble and riding on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey. Brother Bill Yake in 1995, if you know Brother Bill Yake, if I'm ever on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, Bill Yake is going to be my phone a friend. He knows more in his little finger than I know in my whole body. He is the most well-researched person on the face of the earth, I'm convinced. And he did a presentation in 1995 that I'll never forget. And it was called Jesus Proof, and you know how I feel about that word, that he was the Messiah. And it was a powerful 5-day class that showed the historicity of Jesus. And I, if you would like to see that presentation, talk to Brother Bill Yake. I can give you his contact information, and he will gladly email you his PowerPoint slides. And if he says he's lost them, then contact me because I have them. But I don't want to give them to you unless he wants you to have them. So this is not, again, original material. But the historicity of Jesus is an important thing to our faith. Very important. Above all, if we apply it to the New Testament as we should, the same sort of criteria that we should apply to other ancient writings containing historical material, we can no more reject Jesus' existence than we can reject the existence of a mass of pagan personages whose reality as historical figures is never questioned. In other words, if you meet somebody that says, Jesus never existed, trust me, if they believe Julius Caesar existed, or if they believe that Alexander the Great was a real person, there's just as much evidence that Jesus walked this earth as there is for those people. That is a comforting thought. This is another interesting thought that came from his class. It seems strange that the text of Shakespeare, it's been in existence less than 208 years at the time of the writing, which was 1929, so a little over, a little under 300 years now, should be far more uncertain and corrupt, the Shakespeare is, than that of the New Testament. And if you know anything about the way that the scriptures have been preserved and the Masoretic texts, you know of the Masoretic texts? The Hebrews, when they copy the Bible over, they count the number of letters and they count the number of words. And if anything is out of place, they shred the whole page. The care that was given to preserving the Bible exactly how it is, historically, should give us some faith in its veracity and its truth. If you've ever had the opportunity to go see the Dead Sea Scrolls, that is a wonderful experience. You got to think about this. They found these scrolls hundreds of years after the Bible had been translated and sort of carried on through generation to generation, and they found perfect matches between what they found in the Dead Sea Scrolls and what has been carried forth through translation after translation. If all the evidence is weighed carefully and fairly, it is indeed justifiable, according to the canons of historical research, to conclude that the tomb in which Jesus was buried and was actually empty on the morning of the first Easter, and no shred of evidence has yet been discovered in literary sources, epigraphy, or archaeology that would disprove this statement. I would submit that that holds true today. You know, there's some, I'm sorry the font's small on this, but there are some proofs. Again, I don't use this term lightly. This term freaks me out, proof. But in total, these proofs together, there is a historical reliability of the burial account that supports an empty tomb. Gospel accounts of resurrection are reliable in the respects that eyewitnesses are mentioned by name, and it was written within the generation that Jesus was crucified and resurrected. The preaching would have been silenced if the tomb wasn't empty. If there was any controvertible evidence at that point that they could bring forth and say, nope, look, the body is still here, that somebody would have said it. Nobody did. Why? Because it was gone. The earliest Jewish propaganda against the Christians presupposes an empty tomb, that Jesus' tomb was not venerated as a shrine supports it. All of these different pieces of evidence. Like I said, Bill gives a wonderful summary of just hundreds and hundreds of pieces of supporting evidence. In 1 Corinthians 15, verse 6, you know, remember, he appeared to 500 eyewitnesses all at once. Something like that. That's like, I'm a conspiracy theorist to some degree. I'm a skeptic, just like I'm raising a skeptic that doesn't believe that you can play baseball with a broken arm. But, you know, there's a conspiracy theory that we never landed on the moon. And it would be really hard to fool that many people within NASA. And this is the same thing here. If you've got 500 people, you've got to have everybody there get on the same page, make a pact in blood that you'll never reveal what really happened. So another great piece of evidence. I want to end with just two thoughts about proofs of the resurrection of Jesus, and I want to bring it current for you. So we'll bring history up to the present. The change in disciples' behavior and disposition was marked. It was noticeable. It was obvious. The love that they had for each other, the persistence that they had as a people of faith, the preaching that they did. Certainly you would agree it would be improbable that 11 men would give up the pursuit of happiness, which we talked about yesterday was so important, to lead to a life of poverty and persecution. They couldn't have stolen the body, even if they had wanted to. Nothing else reasonably accounts for this empty tomb. Nothing else accounts for it. Now, God appreciates our skepticism. He understands our weaknesses. He's given us a mountain of evidence. But with all of that, I think we're given this passage in John 20 that I want to end with for a reason. John 20, verses 24 to 31. One of the 12 disciples, Thomas, called the twin, was not with them when Jesus came, so the other disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord." Thomas said to them, "Unless I see the scars of the nails in his hands and put my finger on those scars and my hand in his side, I will not believe." A week later, the disciples were together again indoors, and Thomas was with them. The doors were locked, but Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here. Look at my hands. Then reach out your hand and put it in my side. Stop your doubting and believe." Thomas answered him, "My Lord and my God." Jesus said to him, "Do you believe because you see me? How happy, how blessed are those who believe without seeing me." In his disciples' presence, Jesus performed many other miracles which are not written down in this book. But these have been written in order that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that through your faith in him, you may have life.